And now let's go down to verse 12. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith Jehovah, that I will send unto him wanderers. He's talking about how God is going to be dealing with Moab. No, how God is going to be dealing with the churches as they are represented by the Moabites. We find here he's saying, I will send unto him wanderers that shall come to him to wander, and shall empty his vessels and break their bottles. This matter of wanderer, why did he use that? We go back to Jeremiah 2, verse 20, and there we get a little bit more insight as to how God is using that time. Remember, the Bible is its own dictionary, and we read there God is coming at the church age again with other kind of language altogether. But he is saying in verse 20 of Jeremiah 2, for of old time I have broken thy yoke and burst thy bands, and now says, I will not. That word transgress is a wrong translation. It really should have been translated, I will not serve. I will not serve. That is, I will not bow down to God. When upon every high hill and every green tree. Now, high hill and green tree, as we go through the Bible, identifies with the worship of heathen gods. Every time they found a nice knoll, a nice high hill with some trees on it, they build an altar to Baal or to Ashtoreth or to one of the heathen gods of the land. I went upon every high hill and every green tree, thou wanderest playing the harlot. In other words, a wanderer are those who are going from one heathen god to another, and you're playing the harlot. You are in total adultery, total rebellion against God. And here God says in Jeremiah 48, verse 12, I will send unto him wanderers. They will be coming in, and they are coming in with their interest in their false gods. It's exactly the way the churches develop so many tares in them, so many weeds in them, because these are wanderers. These are people who come in, they're not a child of God. They look like they're a child of God. They look like the wheat, and there's no way to separate them from the wheat, but in actuality, they have their own idea of what God is. And, we don't, in our day, we don't come in with here, I want you to serve Baal, I want you to serve, it's all in the language, it's all deception. Like we read in a couple of verses earlier, it's deception. They come in looking so sweet and holy and biblically oriented. They can quote a number of verses very definitely, and yet through it they are bringing a gospel that is a false gospel, a do-it-yourself. Like, for example, you hear people who really, and in their own heart, they think that they have the truth, of course, but they constantly say, oh, dear brother, just call on the name of the Lord, and he is guaranteed he will save you. You just call upon him. Well, that all sounds great, but it's not coming with the truth, because how do you know whether he will save you? Are we saved because we do something, or are we saved because it's all in God's hand? And so it sounds very attractive, very nice. Or here comes someone else who says, you know, I came from this other church or this other denomination, and we always used to do this. We had a baptismal font, and it was beautiful. I want to introduce this to this congregation. And so he makes a great big fetish out of baptism of some kind. Oh, that looks good. That looks neat. And so it's another way of introducing another kind of a gospel into the congregation, because they're abusing their teachings of the Bible altogether. These wonders, you know, that business that we read about in verse 10, deceit. And you know, it's one thing to be deceived by someone and you know full well he is a liar. And you've had that happen. People come to you with a proposition of some kind and you look at them in the eye and you don't want to be rude, but you're thinking you're a big fat liar. You know he is lying. Well, you haven't been deceived. He's not a very experienced liar. He's giving it away. But now someone comes to you and he has a smooth line and a very attractive line and a nice personality, and he shows a lot of interest in you and so on, and he is giving you a bill of goods, and man, it sounds good. Oh my, that sounds good. And so you listen, and maybe you're taken in, and then afterwards you learn that this man was a liar. He was deceiving you. Now, he's a deceiver. He's a practiced liar. He knows what he's doing. And this is the kind of thing that God has in view here also, that there are wanderers that come in and they bring in their deception. And the next thing, the congregation loves this man so much, they just can't wait to put him in the consistory or in the council or in the board of deacons. Oh, he would be a terrific addition. Look at all the interesting ideas, and look what an experienced businessman he is, or whatever. And look how humble he walks. Oh yes. You can take on the appearance of being very humble and not being humble at all. That's all part of the deception. And so we find that what is happening is the wine bottles are being broken. The vineyard is not producing anything that is available to anyone. This is the kind of language that God uses. Then we go on to verse 13. And Moab shall be ashamed of Chemosh, as the house of Israel was ashamed of Bethel, their confidence. Now, this is a very interesting parallelism here. Chemosh was the god that the Moabites served. Many years later, the nation of Israel, when it became a nation, Bethel became part of their country. And what happened at Bethel? Go back to 1 Kings chapter 12, and we find there that Jeroboam, the first king over Israel, when Israel was divided from Judah upon the death of Solomon, and we read in verse 1 Kings chapter 12, Jeroboam, who of course was an unsaved, a wicked king, verse 27, he says, if this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then shall the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said unto them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And he set one in Bethel. Now that word Bethel means house of God. That is the place where Jacob was going to get away from Esau, however we want to put it. There, remember, he had his dream, and he said, this is the house of God. as he saw the angels ascending and descending on a ladder. Who it was emphasizing that the time would come when God would have messengers going up to heaven. That is, they became believers, and then they would descend on Christ as the ladder to go out into all the world with the gospel. Bethel identified as the house of God. But Jeroboam now does it as wickedly as possible. That wonderful city, that city with that kind of heritage, now has become a place of terrible idol worship. The two, the calves are there, and Israel worships there. And so this would be a reference from Jeremiah 48, even as Bethel. Now remember, this was being written, the book of Jeremiah is being written long after that division of the kingdom into Israel and Judah, and it's calling attention to that. Even as it was in Bethel, or even as he's linking that to the wickedness of the Moabites in serving the false god Chemosh. Chemosh doesn't bear any relationship to Jehovah God at all. At Bethel, that was the house of Jehovah God, in a real sense. Even the name Bethel means house of God. But now Bethel has become a place of the worship of golden calves, and it is idol worship altogether. And so he's saying here in verse 13, Moab shall be ashamed of Chemosh as the house of Israel was ashamed of Bethel, their confidence. Now actually, this sentence would read a little bit more accurately if we read it, Moabite shall be ashamed because of Chemosh, as the house of Israel became ashamed, or was shamed, because of Bethel, their confidence. I've expanded that because it is a word that has a very broad range of meanings, which can also include the idea of because. The shame, this again is pointing Israel, will be ashamed because of. We find this sprinkled all through the Bible, the idea of shame that comes upon us because of our sins. Fact is, when we sin, we are shaming God. Every time we sin, we are shaming God. But we're also bringing shame on ourselves. And just as the criminal who has done horrible things, he has shamed his family, he has shamed himself because of the awful things that he has done. And his very name carries the idea of shame because of what he has done. And that's the way God looks upon the sinner. We are shamed. Now, we who are the sinner and who are under the wrath of God, we don't understand we're shamed. We don't feel the shame. But in the eyes of God, they were created in the image of God. And this is what God has in reference, that Moab shall be ashamed because of Chemosh, as the house of Israel was ashamed because of Bethel, their confidence. That it was a shame what they were doing, and later it would be a shame as they came under the wrath of God. Now we go on. How say ye, we are mighty and strong men for the war? For what war? We are mighty and strong men for the war. You know, isn't it interesting how often we're singing Onward Christian Soldiers? We're in a war. Stand up for Jesus is another song that carries the same kind of an idea. We're soldiers of the cross. Who are we fighting against? Well, we're fighting against the enemy, the Satan. We are fighting against sin. We've taken on the whole armor of God. We're fighting, as we read in Ephesians chapter 6, we're fighting against principalities and powers, against his onslaughts as he attempts to con us into sin. And so here, the God is picking up that theme. How say ye, we are mighty and strong men for the war? The way it's written, we get the picture. Of course you're not strong men. You have nothing going for you. You are actually a servant, a slave of the very one you are fighting against, because you are going against God, and you are wanting to go your own way. Then it goes on, Moab is plundered, is spoiled, ruined, and gone up out of her cities, and his chosen young men are gone down to the slaughter, saith the king whose name is the Lord of hosts. The word chosen is a bad translation because it conveys the idea of the elect. The minute you see that word chosen, you right away think, now how does that fit into this historical parable? Because this is what it is. It's all speaking finally about what's happening in the churches. But the word chosen normally is always translated choice or best. Choice or best. And in other words, the best that you can offer, the choicest, that has nothing to do with election. It has nothing to do with God's election program at all. But the best that you can offer is still nothing. Your best young men are gone down to the slaughter. And you thought you were winning the war, but actually you are being plundered. You are being destroyed as God is preparing you for the final destruction. In fact, he's really focusing on the day of judgment, because the great tribulation transitions right into the day of judgment. His chosen young men are gone to the slaughter. And God, that idea of being killed is sprinkled all through the Bible, because the wages of sin is death. Death. And then you're done. You're still going to be shamed, but you don't know anything about that any more than you may not know anything about the enormous heritage of the new heaven and the new earth that you have thrown away, that it was potentially possible for you if you had become a child, and it would have been a part of your blessing if you had truly become a believer. And then it goes on, the calamity of Moab is near to come, and his affliction hasteth fast. And remember, this is right at the end of the church age. The churches have become very, very polluted. The wanderers have done their work. There's all kinds of false teachings going on. They have driven out all the true believers, or the true believers have left. And now they are ready for the final calamity, the day of judgment. In verse 17, all ye that are about him, bemoan him. And all ye that know his name, say, how is the strong staff broken and the beautiful rod? And, oh my, we have come right to the end of our time. We have to, we'll start with that verse in our next study. And you see, as we are understanding this as a parable, how it begins to open up, and we see the spiritual teachings of it.